Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin in Syria because amid all the celebrations at the fall of the Assad regime and the joy of those who've now escaped the horrors of his prisons, there is, of course, much grief and sadness for the families who've been unable to find their missing fathers and sons and those who found only their dead bodies. Among them, a man whose devastating accounts of the regime's torture chambers helped the world understand its cruelty and depravity. He was Mazen al-Hamada, and his body was found on Monday in the morgue of the Saydaniya prison just outside Damascus. Well, today his funeral was held in the city, and hundreds of people came to pay their respects and to voice their anger at what had happened to Mazen and so many others. From Damascus, Yogita Limaya reports, and a warning that report does include some distressing details.
We're at a hospital where bodies, the dead bodies that were found in Saydaniya prison, a lot of them have been brought. And just as we were here, we saw a family that was crying that has come in. We're still to understand their story, but from what we can tell, they've just found out that their son, the mother who was crying, her son, they've just found out that his dead body has been found. And I can see a younger man, somebody who looks, I think it's his brother, who's just put his face against one of the walls and is weeping. His mother's just been taken inside a room by the nurses just to check her out because she's absolutely inconsolable. His mother is screaming, "My son is gone. He was the youngest one." And she's found the body. As we've been walking around this hospital, more and more people are constantly coming up to us to tell us about family members, many of them multiple family members, who have disappeared. Some have said 2012, 2013, 2015, and they've had absolutely no information. They don't know if they're dead or alive. Because the bodies were brought here, they have come here to search to see if they can find any information about their loved ones.
What is your name, madam?
My name is Mahin.
Tell me, who are you searching for?
His name is Zahir, Muhammad Zahir Khairullah.
Do you believe you will find him alive?
I don't know. That's from God. I don't know. I hope, but I don't know.
At the hospital, I'm standing just outside a shed-like structure where there are about five or six bodies on the ground. Their condition really bad, horribly disfigured. There's a really bad smell, very foul smell emanating from them. And people are coming here, trying to cover their noses to identify their loved ones from bodies you can barely identify. In fact, in one corner there's a bag which is just full of human skeletons, just a skull and bones, and this is what people are having to endure. Loved ones who they have not, they don't know, they haven't heard from them for 12 years, 13 years, more than that, just coming here, going through the trauma of having to search through these horribly disfigured bodies. Who are you searching for today?
I am searching for my two sons. We're in confinement for 11 years. So they told us they died.
So have you come here in hope that you might find their bodies?
I can't find in many skeletons here. It's a tragedy, this. How can you find a person as a skeleton? It is a tragedy.
One of the bodies identified was that of activist Mazen al-Hamada. Today it was returned to his family for his funeral. A very rousing procession, funeral procession for activist Mazen Hamada is underway on the streets of Damascus right now. He's someone who participated in the anti-regime protests in 2011, was arrested, tortured, and when he was released the first time, he was able to go to Europe, and while he was there, he spoke repeatedly and in detail about the kind of torture he faced. Rape, breaking of ribs, breaking of bones, his genitals being clamped. And it was largely because of testimony of people like him that came out of Syria. The world was able to understand the scale of the brutality that was being inflicted by the regime on anyone who spoke against Assad. His body was found in the Saydnaya prison, along with dozens of other prisoners, in a horrific condition. We spoke to a doctor who examined the body, and he said it bore the marks of brutal torture. And his family believes that he was killed just shortly before Bashar Assad fled, his regime fell. His sister Lamia told us that she's happy the regime fell, but wishes he was alive to see it. He paid the price for our freedom. I want his killers to be brought to court for justice, she said. This is a country where the people, the families of the missing, did not even have the right to come and ask where their loved ones are, for fear that they would be arrested and tortured. It is a dramatic turn of events that today you are seeing a funeral freely on the streets, a procession.
Yogita Lemai reporting from Damascus. Well, it's thought that 150,000 people were in prison at any one time during the Assad era. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, more than 100,000 prisoners died inside those jails. But many inmates are now free. Some of them were locked up for decades. Many of them endured torture inside. So how will these survivors now cope? I've been speaking to Anne Salter, a psychotherapist from the UK charity Freedom from Torture. Anne's worked with refugees from Syria who have been tortured.
The aim of torture is to break a human being, is to dehumanise somebody, almost strip away their humanity and their very self. So we know that people are coming out of those prisons who have been in there a long, long time, for years. I mean, it's horrendous to think of. So those people will be living in absolute fear for much of the time. And when people come out of that setting, the brain and the body doesn't suddenly readjust to, okay, I'm in everyday life, I'm safe now, I'm fine. That sense of threat and of alarm and constant danger, that continues for a long, long time.
And how does that manifest itself?
It can be difficult to form relationships. It can be difficult to know who to trust, to know how to build up trust. And people feel as if they're living in the past, as if the past is actually present, is still happening. So people can become terrified of ordinary everyday triggers, such as alarms going off, car alarms, police sirens, police officers, or people dressed in a certain way. And it can have a really detrimental impact on family relationships. So we have worked with families and couples where the partners do everything they can to prevent the other one finding out what has happened to them. So if both partners have been tortured, they do not want to know because of feelings of shame.
Really? So people feel ashamed because they've been tortured?
Yes.
And what guilty too, even though, of course, they've done nothing wrong.
They've done nothing wrong. That's one of the most insidious effects of torture, is the sense of shame that it can engender. So if we think that torture is invasive, intrusive, sets out to undermine somebody's very sense of self. So there's a real shame that can be elicited with that, and like an ongoing, enduring shame. And also guilt, as you say, often for putting their loved ones through the horror or the grief of their imprisonment and torture, and their loved ones not knowing if they're safe or what's happening to them. And even threats that their loved ones can be under, kind of by association.
And so how difficult is it then to come back into society, especially when it's so abrupt and sudden, as in the case of
yes.
prisons being opened up by those rebel forces? I mean, I read about one man who was found wandering around and he couldn't remember where his family lived. He'd been in prison
yes.
for so long.
It's just so heartbreaking seeing those images. And I would imagine those people are disorientated, like that gentleman that you describe, disorientated, don't know where to go or what to do. And it does take time. And we at Freedom From Torture offer specialised specialist services. Real specialist services is needed to help people rebuild their lives, reconnect with who they are, reconnect with communities, wherever those communities are, and to start to see a hopeful future for
themselves. So do you think that organisations like the one that you work for will be heading to Syria to help people? Because there's not going to be local services available for them, is there?
Yes. I hope, and I don't know, that there will be services available in Syria to support the population, because as you've suggested, we're not just talking about individuals. It's happened at a population level. And even those people who haven't been directly impacted, they will have been living under the terror of, well, it could happen to me, or could happen to my family.
And is it right that a traumatised population, people also traumatised and brutalised by the civil war as well, even those who weren't necessarily in prison, that sort of cycle of threat and violence can be perpetuated if it isn't, you know, if people don't get the help that they need?
Yeah, it's absolutely vital that people get help right now. When an earthquake happens, people need rescuing, people need saving, and then people need urgent medical treatment. It's an analogy. So as well as the physical treatment that people will need, there's also the psychological care and rebuilding individually and across communities. Because this kind of trauma can last for generations if we don't do something now.
And Anne, can people come back from extended periods of torture and perhaps solitary confinement? Or is it something that will stay with those people, at least on some level, for the rest of their lives?
I would say people absolutely can come back from it. I mean, and we have seen it in Freedom From Torture, in our organisation. People do come back. People build amazing lives for themselves after going through horrors. It can never completely go away. I think experience as profound as that will always be there at some level. But people can and do rebuild their lives.
Anne Salter, a psychotherapist who works with the charity Freedom From Torture. We'll have more from Syria a little later in the programme in about 15 minutes' time here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Also coming up on the programme, some good news for people who don't like injections. Scientists think that one day vaccines could be given with a simple cream applied to the skin. How did this discovery come about?
It was more of a stumble. I think that we, you know, we're sometimes prisoners of our own model of the world. And for those of us who've been studying the friendly bacteria that live in the gut and on the skin, we had thought too much. They're helpful and only there to help.
More on that coming up in just over half an hour. Our main headlines from the newsroom. Israel said it will not pull its troops from the demilitarized buffer zone it shares with Syria, receiving backing from the United States. And a British hedge fund manager has been jailed for 12 years by a court in Denmark for committing fraud worth $1.3 billion. This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Now, British military veterans who were sacked or even imprisoned because of their sexuality can now claim compensation. The government has put aside £75 million, that's almost $100 million for the scheme, and individual veterans could be eligible for up to $90,000. They can also apply to have their rank restored and discharge reason amended. Until the turn of the century, LGBT people were banned from serving in Britain's armed forces. I've been talking to Andrew Hartle, who was a medic in the Royal Air Force until he was ordered to resign. He's now a medical professor at Imperial College London and works with an organisation, Fighting With Pride, that campaigned for this compensation. He told me what happened to him 28 years ago.
I'd been in the Air Force from the age of 19. I joined as a very naive teenager, very uncertain of my sexuality. Almost 13 years later, when I was in my early 30s, I definitely reconciled myself to being gay and, in fact, was planning to leave the Air Force as a consequence. But before that could happen, I was outed in a national Sunday tabloid, which no longer exists. And so the fact that I was gay became public knowledge. And as a direct consequence, I was initially suspended by the RAF and subsequently ordered to resign. So dismissed because I'm gay.
How did it end up in a paper? Did someone sell the story?
Yeah, so somebody I had had a brief relationship with sold the story to the newspaper. The story they approached the newspaper with was that I was a gay, HIV-positive military surgeon who'd operated on the Queen at Buckingham Palace. But the only bit about it that was true was that I was gay, but just being gay was enough for the Air Force to get rid of me.
What did you do then when you were forced to leave? I mean, what was going through your mind at that time?
I'd already reconciled to the fact that I was going to leave the Air Force. I just hadn't planned to do it in quite such a spectacular or painful style. I was quite determined to pursue a medical career, and I was actually pretty cross and very motivated to be successful. And I can remember stating in my resignation documents that I didn't accept that being gay was a barrier to being a successful RAF officer and that my career had demonstrated the truth of that.
And so what's your reaction to news of this compensation? Is it enough?
I don't think anyone's ever going to say that compensation's enough. One of the difficulties, though, James, is that we don't really know how many veterans are going to apply. And it's quite difficult to set the pot if you don't know how many potential veterans there are. And the way that records were kept, it's still not certain how many LGBT veterans were dismissed during that period when the ban existed. And remembering that for many of my veteran colleagues, they were not able to have successful civilian careers. Many of them had to declare that they'd had dishonorable discharges or they had worse criminal convictions. Some of them, even worse, appeared on the sex offenders register and found it very difficult to find paid employment. So they've lost careers and not had comfortable lives since then. So £50,000 may bring them some short-term benefit, but it's not going to suddenly give them lifelong security.
But I mean, were there mental scars? I mean, it must have soured your relationship with the Air Force. I mean, were you proud to serve with them? And does this sort of go some way to correcting that?
Well, I'm quite lucky. I made my peace with the modern Air Force through my professional career. I had begun working with RAF and defence anaesthesia. So I sort of made my peace professionally. Successful civilian career notwithstanding, there have been some pretty significant mental health scars that frankly I buried for quite a long time. And then it all came out for me about 8 years ago. I had a bad period with my mental health, which, you know, with a lot of help, I've managed to come back from. So today for me is an end point of a much longer journey of reconciliation. I think for many veterans, that process of reconciliation is still ongoing. They've spent a long time, 25 to 50 years in the wilderness, and have only been welcomed back in the last 12 to 15 months. And I can imagine that must be quite a big transition to make for them.
Former military medic, Professor Andrew Hartle. President-elect Donald Trump continues to announce appointments to his administration that'll take power in just over a month. The latest is that Carrie Lake is to become the new director of Voice of America, an international broadcasting network funded by the US federal government, not unlike the BBC World Service. Carrie Lake was herself a journalist for many years. She was a news anchor for a television station in Arizona before running unsuccessfully for governor there and then for senator on a Republican ticket. She has turned on some in her former profession, describing journalists once as monsters. Well, I've been talking to David Enser, director of Voice of America under President Obama, and prior to that had a long career as a reporter, including as a foreign correspondent for ABC News. What does he make of Carrie Lake's appointment?
Well, it's obviously going to worry journalists who work at the Voice of America because of, as you say, her media bashing. She also was someone who has frequently said that Donald Trump won in 2020, which he did not. That's just not a fact. So she will be a worrying, her appointment will be worrying the journalists in the Voice of America, which of course, you know, has a long history since the 1940s of the goals of objectivity and fairness and telling America's story on the air. And they reach over 350 million people a week in 49 languages. So will this continue? Will she allow real journalism to be done going forward? It's hard to say.
Having run the organization, how much damage potentially could she do?
A great deal. There's something called a firewall, which is supposed to protect the journalists from politicians, from the president of the United States, even allowing them to tell without fear or favor what is in fact going on. Will that firewall be removed? It could be by a president who has control of both houses of Congress, no question. So we just don't know right now what the intentions are.
I'm not here to speak for President Trump. I mean, he would no doubt say that he was elected to shake up politics, and he's certainly done that. But I guess he might say, look, I need to shake up how America speaks to the rest of the world and reflect my America.
That's right. And, you know, he's within his rights to do so if he wishes to. I would just point out, and I think the studies that we've done, the audience surveys that we've done in the past, but also that your organization have done, have shown pretty conclusively that the largest audience globally wants to hear news that attempts to be correct in everything, rather than a propaganda voice from one political party or one politician. However, if he decides that he wants to have a Voice of America that's really a voice of Trump, there'll still be people who want to listen to that, probably fewer people, but there'll still be an audience for it, I would think.
And we know that many countries around the world, powerful countries, understand what soft power can do.
Indeed. And Voice of America has historically been and is now an incredibly powerful piece of America's soft power. It reaches so many people in so many languages that I would be sorry to see it in some way diminished, which I think it would be if it were turned into a propaganda voice for the Trump administration. But that said, there'll still be people wanting to know what it has to say, no question.
David Ensor, former director of Voice of America and President Obama until 2015. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, a sliver of joy. You may remember the riots in the UK earlier this year, driven largely by far-right agitators. Among the places badly damaged was a public library in Liverpool. It's called Spellow Library, and more than $300,000 were raised for repairs and replacement books lost in the fire. Last night, on the eve of reopening, public libraries around the country lit up in solidarity with Spellow. And in Liverpool, local school children celebrated with a lantern parade. Katie Hasseldine was there.
My name's Riley and I'm 8.
Tell me about how you felt when you found out that the library had been burnt.
Not very happy because it's somewhere that people like to go.
I was very sad because that's a library I always go to and I love reading.
Why are you so excited? Tell me what you'll enjoy about the library.
I probably enjoyed the way that it's so calm because I get annoyed lots easily by the noise, honestly.
What kind of books do you like reading?
Joke books and stuff.
Joke books. Have you got any good jokes for me?
Yeah.
Go on then.
Why did the Queen George Strait land? Because she was the ruler.
Very good. Very good. What's the first thing you're going to do the next time you visit?
Return me books.
They'll be long overdue by now, won't they? And they're off. A huge blue light up there, accompanied by its cub, leads this procession from Goodison Park to Spellow Lane Library. The Steel and Sheep Marching Band are who you can hear, bringing the party atmosphere with their light-up instruments. And hundreds of school children and their parents are joining them, carrying lanterns, to bring back the light to Speller Lane Library, which was torched during those riots in the summer. Are you excited for the library to reopen?
Yeah, I'm getting emotional. When I first been down, I was being crying my eyes out.
Oh. That's the only library we go to.
So we're inside the Speller Library now, just reopened by Pearl. Tell me about how you got the honour to lead this evening's parade.
So my principal, Principal Roper, she rang my mum and asked her if I could be nominated to take part in this parade. And my mum said, of course. So I got picked and I'm here.
As the library was reopened, you were one of the first people in here and you were sat reading a book. What book were you reading?
Dog Diaries, I Love Paris.
And did you pick that book then?
Yeah.
Is that one of your favourites?
Yeah, Dog Diaries, I love the series.
Tell me what it's like in here. What was it like before? Is it quite similar?
Yeah, it was very similar, but because most of the things here are burnt down, they've got a lot of new things.
Yeah.
The children's library, they've got a lot of new things, like new chairs and things.
And what are you looking forward to the most then?
I'm looking forward to borrowing that book that I was just reading after the library's opened.
Yeah.
When I was told to stop reading, I'm like, but I want to read more.
Lovely stuff. That was Katie Hasseldine reporting there from Liverpool. You're listening to News Hour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's head back to Syria now, because among those who've been released from prison, there's a 29-year-old American man from Missouri called Travis Timmerman. He's been missing since May this year after he crossed into Syria from Lebanon without permission. And he was found wandering with no shoes on in a neighbourhood south of Damascus. Well, earlier today, he was interviewed by CBS News about conditions in jail.
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't bad. I was never beaten. The only really bad part was that I couldn't go to the bathroom when I wanted to. I was only let out 3 times a day to go to the bathroom. So that was quite the hardship.
And you had food and water?
I did.
He was interviewed by CBS's senior foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer. How did she think he was?
He seemed well. A little dazed, it could have been shock, and he said he wasn't beaten. He came over the border illegally, which was not a political crime, and it could be that he was treated with decency. He said he was fed and watered. So he didn't look traumatized, but certainly a little overwhelmed.
What did he say about how he was broken out of jail?
He said that the guards of this very notorious jail melted away on Sunday night. On Monday morning, a group of local people came with hammers and levers and just smashed the doors open and let everyone go. He was in a group with about 30 women, so not in the political wing of the prison, and they just began walking. But the extraordinary thing was he had no idea that Assad was gone, and he had no idea that the Islamist rebels were in charge. And afraid and wanting to keep his head down, he decided that he would walk. He would sort of sneak out of the country. And so he began walking toward Jordan. And he was spotted today, having slept rough in abandoned houses since Monday overnight. He was spotted this morning by the caretaker of a village that he was walking through barefoot. And this man, Musa, spotted him for a foreigner right away and thought he needs help, and went up to him and managed to talk him into coming to the man's home and taking some food and water. And then he and his friends posted a video, a social media post, saying, look, we have this man. Does anybody know who he is?
And there is at least one other American citizen, isn't there? A journalist who I think has been missing for much longer than Travis. I mean, more than 10 years, Austin Tice. Is there any news about him?
There is no news of Austin Tice. There are some geographical coordinates coming out of Washington through Syrian contacts that suggest this military base, this prison, might be a good place to look. We've been to a couple and haven't found a thing. It is, I have to tell you, gut-wrenching to not be able to thoroughly explore them. I was in a couple of makeshift prisons today, and I could see that the rebels in charge had not opened every door, had not gone into every basement room. And we couldn't either. We didn't really have the means to blast open these iron doors. And I'm aware now that these prisoners are squirreled away in the most unlikely places. And as I left, I had really had a terrible feeling that we may be turning our backs on not only Austin Tice, but so many other prisoners who, if we don't find them in the next day, 2-3 days, will actually die without realizing that they are free.
CBS News senior foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer speaking to me from Damascus. Well, all the physical expressions of the Assad's power and money are either being torn down or hollowed out. The very centre of that power was Bashar al-Assad's presidential palace in the capital, the place where he'd welcome foreign dignitaries and sometimes journalists, including our international editor Jeremy Bowen. He's been back to the palace and sent us this report.
We've just arrived at the presidential palace, the one that's the big one on the hill overlooking Damascus. Now, there are fighters from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the group that overthrew the Assads here on the gate. I want to get in here because this is where I used to, from time to time, meet President Bashar al-Assad. It is quite an extraordinary feeling walking into this great echoing marble hall of the palace. There's a red carpet and some kind of burnished copper ceiling. It's something about a deserted palace after a dictator has gone. I mean, nothing's really been badly damaged here, but off the main, this main huge marble entrance hall, there are some rather grand reception rooms which are now covered in debris. That's where the fighters have been sleeping. You can see that there are blankets and leftovers of food and half-drunk cups of tea and things like that. It used to be that coming in here you would have to have permission. It was quite an event. And now there are fighters wandering around, journalists like us. I mean, our driver's left the car and he's going around filming like mad. I mean, it's an echoing shell of a place. Probably suitable for what became an echoing shell of a dictatorship.
This is my first time here. This palace is for the people. But the people never set eyes on it. And they never went in. It's like a dream. Even now, we don't believe it. Even now, some people think that he's still here and they are afraid of him because he terrified the people. Even now, some people at home feel like they are watching a dream.
If I just walk out this way and across the checkerboard, marble floor, marble tables, walnut doors, crystal chandeliers. I mean, this is a very opulent place. There was just, and I'm just going in there now through the door, there's this anteroom. So it's an anteroom. It's a sitting room as big as a tennis court. And the way it worked was that before the interview, Assad would take you off for private time for a chat. And because he looked a bit gawky, sometimes people in the West thought he's a bit weak, he can be pushed around. But sitting privately with him, I never had that impression. He instead was a man who was self-confident in his conversation, really to the point of arrogance. He felt that he was the kingpin. He thought he was the spider in the middle of the web of the Middle East, and that he knew exactly what was going on and the right things to do and the best things to do. And he kept, of course, saying it was for the Syrian people, not for the Assad family. While he had all the ruthlessness, his hands were covered in the blood of the Syrian people, he was somebody who, you know, he made mistakes. His judgment was bad. He could have made things better for his not just for his country, but he might even have managed to save his regime if he'd opened up a bit at the very beginning, but he wouldn't do it. And while Bashar al-Assad, when you met him, he was extravagantly polite. When I walked into this room, he'd stand back when the door was open, say, after you. And then if he was sitting down when you came in, he'd leap to his feet, a rather tall, skinny man in an expensive suit. And he'd say, welcome, and, you know, how's the family, and how's your journey? And he never seemed to be the guy, actually, who would be at home in the torture cell, watching people screaming their last. But I always did feel that he wouldn't think twice about giving the order to send the person to the torture cell, or to the jail, or to the gallows. And of course, Bashar al-Assad, his family, his acolytes, his security people, they did that thousands and thousands of times.
That was our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, in Damascus. Chess has a new world champion. He is the youngest ever 18-year-old from India, Gukesh Domaraju, beat the defending champion, the Chinese player Ding Liren. My NewsHour colleague Tim France has been speaking to Levi Rosman, an American chess master and the host of Gotham Chess on YouTube. How big a moment is this?
Huge. Yeah, the youngest world champion in history, beating, you know, the record of Garry Kasparov, which for some of the listeners would certainly resonate.
Yeah, he was all of 22, an old man. Now, just give me a sense. I mean, first of all, it was an extraordinary end to what had been a very, very tight contest, hadn't it? Because they were tied. And then Ding Liren made this astonishing, so I read, astonishing endgame pawn blunder.
Yes. So to give some context to the audience quickly, you know, it's not a knockout. They don't play just one game. They play 14, a best of 14. So you need to win 7.5 points. A half point is for a tied game, and you get 1 point for winning. And it was 6.5, 6.5. And this was the final game. And it was 3-4 hours into the final game. And it was a draw. It was going to be a tie. They were going to go to tie breaks tomorrow. And Ding basically traded off all of his pieces into a completely losing position. And yeah, baffling, astonishing is a, those words are understatements.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's because Gukesh just sort of, the pressure was relentless from him?
It was the pressure. It was the fact that the entire match had been a bit strange. Like, Ding was very happy ending games early, if that makes sense. Imagine a football match was tied 0-0 and they just left at halftime and they never played the second half. He was just sort of happy to do that, kind of conserving his energy, seemingly going for the tie breaks. And today it just came back to bite.
Right. And then, I mean, I was watching, I'm afraid I'm too stupid to understand the intricacies, but much as I play chess at an astonishingly low level, but you didn't have to have any expertise to see the emotion at the end. I mean, it was just, Domaraju, he looked like a young man who was just overcome with emotion.
Yeah, we've almost never seen that. We see chess players hold their heads in their hands. We see athletes cry and everything. Gukesh couldn't contain his smile. He couldn't believe what was unfolding on the board. And you could see him sit back down and try to bite his lip, literally to prevent himself from smiling. But then, you know, you see the celebration and the adoration and the hug with the father after. It's really special. And he knows he's coming home to, you know, over 1 billion people that are cheering for him.
Yeah. And I mean, it is increasingly, it seems, a young man's game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've lost to 11 and 10 year olds that are already better than me, and I'm nearly 30, which, as you said, is a dinosaur for this game.
That was chess master and YouTuber Levi Rosman there talking to Tim Franks about that new chess world champion, that 18-year-old Gukesh Domaraju. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Still more to come on this edition of the program. Time to head to Australia now, because there's a plan to limit the number of international students coming to the country. Universities are warning it could lead to the closure of up to 300 colleges and put thousands of jobs at risk. The government says it wants to cap the number of students from abroad in order to create a better and fairer system, as Phil Mercer now reports.
Graduation is a milestone to savour. But at the University of Sydney, not everyone's celebrating. Casual academic staff fear that planned caps on international students could cost them their jobs.
I have no idea whether I'm going to get work next semester. I'm Sophie Cotton. I'm a casual academic here at Sydney University in the Department of Political Economy. We apply for contracts every semester, and the number of contracts that get given out are dependent on the number of students that we are taking. I'm pretty horrified by the government's management of the university sector over this period. For us here at Sydney University, we're expecting a pretty drastic decrease in the number of commencing students.
But ministers say record levels of immigration, including students, have put more pressure on Australia's housing rental market. There are concerns too that visa loopholes allow some migrants into the country not to study but to work and stay indefinitely. Jason Clare is the Federal Education Minister.
It's important to send a message to the world that we want students to come here to study, but we want a managed system, not a free-for-all system, and we want to make sure that all institutions can benefit.
After iron ore, gas and coal, international education has been one of Australia's most valuable exports. It generated about $25 billion last year. The largest number of students have come from China and India. But the question is, will restricting enrolments from overseas damage Australia's reputation? Australia has one of the world's biggest international student markets, but that could change.
Options for the students are quite a few. Now new destinations have also come up in Europe and Asia and other places. But most of the students who are not coming to Australia would be looking at US and UK as the two alternatives. Ravi Lochan Singh, and I'm the managing director of a company called Global Reach, which has been recruiting for Australian education institutions for the last 33 years. International education is, I think, the third or the fourth biggest export item, is the number one service export. Australia is not a manufacturing country. So if you remove the mining sector, then education is the number one export for Australia. And if we limit this, we could actually make Australia very unwelcoming for international students in future.
Earlier this year, Australia was hosting more than 700,000 international students, a record number. For many like Abby Shi from Shanghai, a political economy and law graduate, it can be a life-changing experience.
I'm culturally a Chinese person for sure. When I go back to China, I notice a lot of the Australian traits coming from me. So yeah, I'm definitely becoming more Australian. I love about that, yeah. And I like all Australian people. They're super friendly and super laid back.
A report from Sydney by the BBC's Phil Mercer. Now, no one likes having a needle stuck in their arm, do they? Indeed, some people are so afraid of vaccinations, it puts them off actually having them. Well, there is some potentially good news on that front, because researchers in the US think they're on course to develop a vaccine that can be applied onto the skin with a cream. The technique involves harnessing the help of a generally harmless type of bacteria that is found on human skin. Professor Michael Fishback of Stanford University has been telling me more about the research.
I think what it reveals is that the immune system has a way to reach from the inside of your body out into the outside world across the skin to grab things that are very close to the skin barrier and develop an immune response against them preemptively.
So was the assumption then that if there are bacteria on the skin, that the skin would be a natural physical barrier and that the body didn't need to produce antibodies because it was assumed that, as I say, that skin would block those bacteria getting in?
Precisely. We had thought of them as our friends, that they're helpful, not harmful. And so maybe the immune system doesn't see them at all, or if it does, it gives a friendly wave and then walks in the other direction. But it turns out that's not at all what happens. The immune system responds quite aggressively against them. And this is something we hadn't anticipated.
So is the principle then that what you try and attach a disease, a toxin, you know, things like diphtheria, tetanus, things like that, onto those bacteria in order to provoke an immune response inside the body. Is that right?
That's right. So then an important thing to note here is that usually we think of the immune system as being responsive to an infection or to something that's like an infection, a vaccination. You have a breach of the barrier, immune cells rush in, there is swelling. What's happening here is that since we've found that the immune system is sort of responding preemptively to these bacteria that live naturally on the other side of the skin barrier, if we just dress them up to look like a pathogen, we wonder whether it might be possible to make something that acts as a vaccine, but could just be applied in a cream and without the swelling.
Yeah, and nobody likes jabs, do they? How far has it got so far? I mean, you've been trying this out on mice.
The response in mice is terrific. The next stop for a vaccine would typically be experiments in monkeys where you can see how well it might work in something that more closely approximates a human. So that's the next step for us. I think we feel optimistic because part of the work that we published showed that humans have a very strong antibody response naturally against this same bacterium that lives on their skin.
And do you think it's going to work with most diseases, the sorts of things that we routinely have injections for?
In principle, it could. Time will tell.
I'm sort of surprised that no one had thought about this before, or perhaps they had. Did you stumble across it, or was it just a bit of inspiration that you had?
It was more of a stumble. I think that we're sometimes prisoners of our own model of the world. And for those of us who've been studying the friendly bacteria that live in the gut and on the skin, we had thought too much they're helpful and only there to help.
What might be the other advantages? I mean, obviously people don't like jabs, as we've mentioned, so that's nicer. But could it be cheaper? Is it likely to make vaccines more available to people in the sense that people are more likely to turn up to have them? I mean, is that all in the realms of possibility?
I think it is. Yeah, one could imagine, since there's no needle and no need for a healthcare worker, that you could even receive it in the mail and rub it on your own skin, which I think would be much more convenient and, of course, easier to distribute in a lower middle income country where distribution is usually challenging. And I think on top of that, there's one additional possible advantage, which is that we noticed when we applied the engineered bacterium to the skin of mice that we saw antibodies developing not just in the bloodstream, where you normally get them from a vaccine, but also inside of the nostrils and on the surface of the lungs. And if we can show that that also happens in a monkey and ultimately a human, then that would prevent the transmission of respiratory viruses like flu, which would be an upgrade over current vaccination technologies.
Professor Michael Fishback of Stanford University in the US. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for your company. Until the next time. Bye-bye.